We'll be answering your personal finance questions today on Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and joining me on the program are regular personal finance expert Kevin Wasby. Kevin is a certified financial planner, and he can handle your questions about devising the best strategies for saving and investing, whether you count yourself as a beginner or someone experienced in financial matters. Plus, Kevin will check up on the couch potato portfolio, the minimal effort approach to investing your money. Joining Kevin on the show, Jake Keebler. Jake's a financial planner with Blue Stem Financial Advisors in Champaign. He can talk about the best ways to keep track of where your money is going, whether you want to do it, well, the old-fashioned way with pen and paper, or if you want to do it electronically with online banking tools and apps. We welcome your phone calls and emails for another hour devoted to personal finance. That's right here on Focus, coming up after this hour's news. Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and this is our monthly program devoted to answering your questions on personal finance. And let's say hello to the folks giving the answers. Kevin Wasby is a certified financial advisor and a lecturer at the University of Illinois College of Business. And Jake Keebler is a financial planner with Blue Stem Financial Advisors in Champaign. Jake, Kevin, well, welcome to Focus.
Good morning, Jim, and thank you.
Good morning, Jim. It's nice to be here.
And you can ask your personal finance questions to both Jake and Kevin over the phone. You can call us at 333-9455 or toll-free at 1-800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 1-800-222-WILL. And you can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. And we also welcome your questions on Facebook and Twitter at Focus580. And, you know, I was just looking over the financial news and for someone from me who's not paying full 100% attention, I guess the thing that I saw most was talk about Ben Bernanke, the fact that he may not be there forever. His term is coming up at the end of the year. And with the departure of Ben Bernanke might be a change in the Fed's stimulus program in the months or the year ahead. Is that the real major concern that someone who's investing should have as far as what affects finances?
Let me take that first, Jake, if you wouldn't mind. I wouldn't call it a major concern, Jim. I would just basically say it's an element of news that a person should be aware of. It really shouldn't affect long-term planning, nor should it affect probably what actions a person takes in managing their affairs financially. Let me separate the two statements that you made somewhat. Ben Bernanke's term does expire at the end of the year. The odds-on bet is that he will not be reappointed to a new term. Further odds-on bet are that the deputy chair, Janet Yellen, the president of the Federal Reserve of San Francisco, will probably assume the chair of the Federal Reserve. But bottom line, those transitionary events are separate from perhaps policy. Janet Yellen and Ben Bernanke are birds of a feather. I think most of change of policy is related to Wednesday this week when the press conference followed the Federal Open Market Committee meeting results. In other words, what the Fed does as a regular means of communicating interest rate policy to the world. So this Wednesday, the shift was one of, well, two things. The Fed sees a recovery in the United States gaining traction, and they say that if evidence continues to support a recovering economy, that they will begin to wind down the extraordinary liquidity measures that they've had in place since literally 2008. So that was kind of the news event of the week.
What does that mean if that happens, if we see a wind down in the stimulus program? What would that mean for investors?
Well, in actuality, I think that's the market tantrum that we saw over the past couple of days. I mean, in a nutshell, it means interest rates will move higher than the record low interest rate levels we've seen over the past 2-3 years.
And that's bad for someone, but good for someone else, I would assume.
Well, yeah, it's always a two-sided coin. Anybody that has been punished with the rate of return they've been receiving over the past 2, 3 to 5 years with things like certificates of deposit will see some relief with a rise in those rates. Obviously, the person that has been benefiting from the cheap cost of money, whether it's for a purchase of a house, refinancing an existing mortgage on a house, or using borrowed money to purchase assets in general, is going to see an increase in cost and therefore, in theory, a decrease in value of those assets.
And Jake Keebler, is this something you've been watching? And have your clients been asking you about what's going on here?
In general, our clients don't tend to ask too many questions in terms of what the economic data is going on and how that affects them personally. And I think that partly goes back to the approach that we take in our financial planning process, which Kevin touched on very briefly, which is it's one detail of many details that are going on. And there's so many factors that go into how investors are reacting to the market that nobody really knows how that's going to change. So with our own clients, we put the focus on what is it in your life that you have control over, and let's make sure we've got those factors right. And then we'll try to plan for scenarios that may be in or not in the client's favor. But let's spend most of our time focusing on what are you doing right and what can you be doing better.
And that does sound like a more deliberate, maybe long-term, taking a long view of your investments.
Exactly.
And I guess, I'm reading this off of CNN, for example, and you turn on the business cable channels. There are a lot of bright, shiny objects zooming across the horizon on that programming. And maybe are there investors who like to be really hands-on and doing things every day, and either they find it personally rewarding and maybe financially rewarding as well? Is that just a different person from, the clients that you work with, Jake?
Right. And I think it really comes down to the type of investment philosophy that a person has. And there's really two main camps when it comes to investing. There's those who believe in active management, in which they feel like doing research or analysis, they can in some way outperform the market or make informed decisions about what they think the next hot investment's going to be. And then there's those in what I would call the passive camp or the index camp. And that's really where I tend to lie in our own client's portfolio tends to be, which is more of an approach of there's too many factors that go into figuring out how the market's going to respond. So instead of constantly trying to focus on what should I be buying or what should I be selling next, we focus on getting a broad, diversified portfolio and try to get market returns at the lowest cost possible.
So when either of you see an event like, well, that's described by CNN, for instance, as the worst sell-off of 2013 happening earlier this week, how do you take that? Is that a big dramatic thing that happens that people have to pay attention to, or is it just one more brick in whatever's going on here?
Well, I'd like to jump in on what Jake just said here. That was an excellent way to really put perspective on your question, Jim. It depends is the answer. So just to follow on with Jake's overview of active versus passive management, I'll take you back to one of my favorite books. I read it about every 5 years, whether I need to or not. It's a 1942 book. It's been updated a couple of times, but basically, Benjamin Graham, the father of fundamental analysis, Graham and Dodd, a 1928 book that's still in most on most analysts' bookshelf. An analyst as opposed to a financial planner. But the bottom line is this. Graham laid out very clearly in the beginning of the book that active versus passive management really shouldn't have a discussion about which is better, but which is more appropriate. And it really boils down to a person's interests, and it boils down to perhaps even their vocation. If they're of the interest to want to do analysis and try to find things that are undiscovered by the general crowd, that's fine. If that's the choice made, then there are certain things that Graham prescribed as being things to look at to try to determine that value. If a person doesn't have that inclination or doesn't have that vocation, that's fine too. The index approach is a very time-worn, in the statistical testing of results of active versus passive managers and all of the statistical baggage that goes along with that testing, the passive approach has shown to be the more cost-effective and rewarding approach. So it's like coffee. Do you like it with cream or do you like it black?
Okay. Maybe keeping that in mind, I wanted to touch on what's been a regular feature of our personal finance shows on Focus, and that's the couch potato portfolio, which I think was set by David Sinow a while back, but we're still following. And if you go to our website at will.illinois.edu, you'll see the latest numbers for the couch potato portfolio. And, Kevin, maybe you can just give a summary of what we're looking at when we're looking at the couch potato portfolio and what you can expect from this sort of maybe least possible effort approach to investing.
Sure. And again, as you've mentioned, this was something that David Sinow, the regular guest in this spot for years, set up a number of years ago. And it is an approach using index mutual funds to what I would say a rather equity-heavy based allocation. But for the lack of a better type of description, I would say this is a passive approach or an alternative to one way a person might allocate investments into equity mutual funds in a longer term type of process. So every suggestion has its pros and cons, but this is just one of many. And it's a good thing for listeners, just for nothing other than seeing how things work, to get a glimpse of one way to do it.
And that's on our website at will.illinois.edu/focus. Look for the listing for today's program. Click the button to see a little more, and you'll see the couch potato portfolio right there before you. This is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and we're talking with the personal finance experts today, certified financial advisor Kevin Wasby and Jake Keebler, a financial planner with Bluestem Financial Advisors in Champaign. Call us with your comments or questions about finance. The phone number is 333-9455, 333-WILL. If you're outside the Champaign-Urbana area, call toll-free at 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-WILL. Our email address is will-talk, that's will-talk@illinois.edu. And Jake Keebler, I wanted to talk to you because we were talking a little earlier about just about the best way to approach keeping financial records is keeping track of your finances today, which is a lot more complicated. It's become a lot more complicated for me personally compared to, say, the 1980s when I was balancing a little checkbook, literally the little booklet that they would send me. Now there's all sorts of, first of all, a person's finances may be a lot more complicated than that, but there's also a lot of electronic and online aids to do it with. What do you find works best, whether it's one of those aids or just going back to the pen and paper?
Well, the first question I would actually ask a client interested in tracking spending is, do you need to be tracking your spending? And I would say that there's two or three major reasons why you would or would not want to even begin to kind of see how much is it that I'm actually spending and breaking that down by category. The first would be for tax reasons, for someone who has a need to keep track of income and expenses or a lot of itemized deductions, charitable contributions, things like that. The second would be for people who are overspending. And I would say overspending could be anywhere from someone who's accumulating debt because of an inability to kind of see how much is coming in versus going out. But it can also just be someone who's overspending in the sense of they're not meeting their financial goals because they're not prioritizing saving over consumption. And then the third and final reason that you might want to track spending is just for the person that's interested in seeing how their money's being spent and periodically reviewing that and adjusting their spending based on their values.
And, you know, we were talking a little bit before we went on air about the idea that, you know, some people may not need, for instance, a budget,
right.
but you do need to save. And I even remember last month's personal finance program, Kevin, you were responding to somebody's email of somebody who was figuring out how to handle their financial struggles. And the phrase you used was pay yourself first.
Exactly. It's I guess there are two ways to have money. One is to inherit. The other is to work for it. The necessary ingredient that goes along with either is you have to spend less than you have.
So if you want, Jake, is that the basic strategy that you advise?
Exactly. You know, we tell our clients if you're always spending less than you earn, you're probably going to be okay. But if the opposite's going on, there's almost no way you're going to be okay. So the reason why I said you don't necessarily need a budget is for a lot of people, budgeting tends to be a dirty word because they've had bad experiences in the past where they've tried to set up a budget and they failed at it. So our focus is exactly what Kevin said, pay yourself first. If you're on track to saving towards whatever your goals might be, whether it's college or retirement or maybe even more of a short-term goal like saving for a new car or a house or a vacation, as long as you're making strides and making active choices to lead to savings for that, it doesn't really matter how you spend any remaining discretionary income.
And that raises the question, assuming that budgeting is not necessary for everybody, when does it work? When is it a useful thing to have?
I think it's a very useful thing for people who feel like they could be doing better, they want to be making more progress towards their goals, and they're trying to identify areas where they could cut back spending, or for people who maybe are looking at an increase in income, maybe they're moving into a first job or a new job, and they want to make sure that they're prioritizing any new sources of income to be saved towards their highest goals. Because it's very easy when you have new income coming in to just automatically adjust lifestyle to that new level of spending.
Well, in terms of financial tracking, I was wondering what sort of choices are out there and what do you find works well?
Well, I think it all boils down to your comfort level with technology and whether you'd want to stick to the old pen and paper method using the checkbook register or using even a 3x5 index card that you carry around and write down when you buy things. But for those who are more interested in using technology to help ease that process, there's both desktop-based software that you install on your computer, such as Quicken tends to be one of the big leaders in that field. And then there's also web-based choices that automate a little bit of that process as opposed to the desktop software.
And I guess my technological comfort zone peaked at around 1998, the way it worked for me. I remember using the old Quicken technology, which actually was – it helped for me because it eliminated all my previous math mistakes. But I never got beyond that. Actually, the software I had was killed by Y2K. One of the things I can actually identify as a Y2K victim, and when I came back to Quicken some years later, all of a sudden it was a lot more complicated.
Right. I think Quicken's made strides to reach broader audiences by adding packages for business owners and landlords and tracking your investments. So they've certainly added more and more features. But there are alternatives online that would be a little simpler than Quicken. The two examples that I would point out would be Mint.com, that's MINT.com, which is also owned by the same company that develops Quicken. So it's a very similar software system. And then there's another system that's been gaining some popularity called Envelopes, and that's the letter MVELOPES.com. The Mint.com is going to be much similar to the Quicken system in which it goes out, grabs your checking, your credit card data, pulls it in, and tries to automatically categorize that, and then you can go in and make some adjustments to that. The Envelope system works a little bit differently. that's set up to be almost like an envelope system of tracking spending like you might have done pre-technology, where you just have an envelope or a set of envelopes where you got your paycheck and then you divided that paycheck between a groceries envelope, a mortgage envelope, a vacation fund, and so on and so forth. And when you went to the grocery store, you take your grocery store envelope with you. And if you run out of money, then you either have to stop buying or you have to borrow from your vacation fund or from some other account. So that's how the envelope website is set up to work.
What's the web address and envelope again?
It's M, the letter M, V E.
Oh, that's L. M. Okay.
Right. V-E-L-O-P-E-S.
Okay. Making sure we can find it here online. And there it is. Envelopes.com and Mint.com are a couple of systems that, that you suggest. And this also raises, you're using these and all your data is going out there into somebody else's care, unlike, say, the 1990s Quicken software, which where it all stayed on your PC. This is going out online, which, of course, raises the potential for some privacy problems.
Exactly. And I would want you to be aware before using these systems of how they use that data. For instance, Mint.com is actually a free system. They will not charge you for use of their service. But in exchange, they will collect data on you. So they're going to look at your credit cards and see what your interest rates are. And based on that, they may suggest, here are some other credit cards that you might be interested in. And of course, they're getting paid for that recommendation. So you have to be willing to give them some data in order for them to provide that free service back to you.
But that given, you find that these systems work fairly well, that they're fairly understandable for someone just getting into them to be able to to plug in their numbers and get some useful data back?
They are designed to be very user-friendly. And for some people who are looking for more customization, the web-based versions are not going to be your ideal source. The power of Quicken is the ability to go in and change things, set it up the system that you would like, whereas your more cloud-based or web-based software is going to be a little bit more rigid in terms of what you can do with it.
Okay. Just in the reports you get back from your clients, what do most of your clients use? Are they back on pen and paper, or are they using some of these newer systems?
You know, we have probably three different camps of clients. We have the clients who just don't have a need for tracking spending, who are just frugal in general and tend to bring in more than they spend. We've got the clients who need to track spending for some reason or another, and like the Quicken because they've been on it for years, they understand it, they know how to use it. And then we've got some of the younger, you know, millennial Gen X, Gen Y clients who are just now getting into tracking their spending, and they're really liking these web-based softwares like Mint.com, especially given that they can use it on their home computer, they can use it on their phone, their tablet. They've got apps for various different types of uses.
We're talking about personal finance on Focus today on WILL with Jake Keebler from Bluestem Financial Advisors in Champaign and Kevin Waspy, a certified financial advisor and lecturer at the University of Illinois College of Business. Our phone number is 333-9455, 333-9455, and the toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455. The email address, will-talk@illinois.edu. That's will-talk@illinois.edu. We're going to take a short break now, and we'll be back with some more talk about personal finance on Focus on WILL. Focus on WILL. We're back. I'm Jim Meadows here on the program with Jake Keebler and Kevin Waspy talking about personal finance, talking about some options to use for keeping track of your finances. And our producer, Lindsay Moon, who makes use of Mint, reminds us that one of the things she likes about it is it'll tell her when she goes over budget, and it'll tell her by sending her a text. It's, I guess, a way of nagging in some way, but it's a way of going outside of the software to let you know what's going on.
Right, and I think that's a really nice feature that some of the new technology is giving us is one of the problems that a lot of people have with spending is awareness. They just aren't aware of how much is coming in and how much is going out. And that's what tracking your spending gives you, is it gives you a stronger awareness of how you're spending your money, in what areas are you spending a lot of money. And it also gives you almost this sense of someone's watching over you, because at some point you will be held accountable when you log back in and look at where your money's gone, to force you to stop and think about, am I spending my money in a way that aligns with my goals and values?
And I guess if you find financial matters a little bit intimidating, part of intimidation is I don't want to look because it'll be bad potentially. Mm-hmm. And I suppose if the system you're using is going to tell you immediately when a problem arises, that erases that human tendency to try to avoid finding out the problem. We have a caller coming in now, and we also have some questions on email. I'm going to see if I can keep track of things here and find out. Oh, well, here we are. And line four, we have a caller from Georgetown, Texas. Is that right, Jerry?
Yes, it is.
Okay, because there is a Georgetown closer to home, but you're from farther away. Well, welcome to Focus.
Well, thank you. Yes, I used to listen when I was in the Chicago area, but recently I've come down here.
Well, if you have a question for Kevin or Jake?
Yeah, I was, like most people, I've watched over the past 30 years the decline of the bonds and the income-producing side of the house, and I'm anticipating, like most people, we're going on up the other side of the curve from now on, or at least for quite a while. And what's your thoughts about where income might be found under those circumstances? Certainly money market and things like that just don't do it. So do you have some thoughts about that that might be helpful to your, not just me, but the audience?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's probably as timely now with what's been happening with rates in the past couple of days. But let me go back and remind you, as a longtime listener, you know that I'm an advocate of ladders when it comes to managing CDs, bonds, even to a certain extent, bond mutual funds. I've always enjoyed the fact that I don't know the future. And as stupid as that sounds, let me say it again. I've always enjoyed the fact that I don't know the future.
Okay, yeah.
So bottom line is, I might have feelings that interest rates are going higher, but I don't know that. The beauty of a ladder basically is, and real quickly, what is a ladder of maturities? Take $10,000, split it into four equal chunks, $2,500 each, put it in a 1 year, 2 year, 3 year, 4 year CD. Every year, take the principal from the maturing CD, go out and buy a new 4 year CD. The reason this is done is obviously you have no immediate need for the money, so you have an opportunity to get a higher rate of return in a normal interest rate environment than just keeping it in a money market. A money market, to me, is a transactions account. That means the money better be liquid and available because it's going to be needed for a specific use. If you get any rate of return on it at all, it's a bonus, but it's a transactions account.
And it is covered by FDIC, right? And I guess that's a plus for it, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, a money market account, whether it's at a bank that has FDIC insurance coverage, or what I would call a money market mutual fund that does not have FDIC insurance coverage at the present. We can go into history in 2008 and a financial meltdown and all that good stuff in some history lesson, over an adult beverage, I might add. What I would say is, whether you're looking at an insured deposit product at a bank or credit union, so CDs, or whether you're looking at individual bonds that are basically the obligations of the borrower, or whether you're looking at mutual funds that pool those types of individual bonds, The important part about a ladder of maturity is it's an admission that you don't know the future of interest rates.
Yes.
But what happens is, and let me give you real quick scenarios. In a normal interest rate environment, that means the yields are higher on longer term to maturity instruments. You end up in a process where interest rates are stable over time. If you think about it, a four-year ladder, as I just gave you the example, after 3 years, you're earning the four-year rate on all of your money, but a quarter of it comes due every year. So your average maturity is 2 years. You get access to a quarter of your money every year, and you're earning the four-year rate.
Mm-hmm. If interest... Yeah, I was looking at that as a possibility, but also do annuities make any sense under this current environment?
Well, annuities are a whole different product. We're talking now about insurance contracts. Insurance contracts tend to offer opportunities within the contract itself that might lend a person or lead a person to believe that it's mimicking something like a fixed income product. I generally, and I'll turn this over to Jake in just a minute and be quiet here, but generally speaking, I do not advocate the use of annuities for things that would be what I would consider to be fixed income assets as a part of a portfolio. Annuities fill a different niche or a different reason or need for an investment vehicle within a portfolio.
Mm-hmm. I see. Okay. And therefore, they're not to be looked at as a one-for-one replacement.
I would never call them a substitute, no.
Jake, did you have anything more you wanted to add to that?
I think I would agree with a lot of what Kevin said, especially on the I cannot see the future. And in fact, I don't think that if I could see the future, I probably wouldn't be in Central Illinois. I'd probably be, you know, on a vacation right now in, you know, Europe or something. But, you know, if I understand the question, you're kind of looking at how to maximize income given the current interest rate environment. And I think it goes back to one of the most fundamental concepts of investing, which is if you want a higher rate of return, you have to take on a higher level of risk. So the thing that we would actually do in our own portfolios is something very similar to what Kevin was talking about, which would be for current income, we'd be looking at a laddered product, whether it's CDs or a very safe investment like Treasury, something like that. And then because you've got some set guarantee of I have this much money maturing over the next X amount of years, you then have the ability to take a little bit of risk on the remainder of the portfolio. But it's all got to come back to how much risk are you comfortable taking? What is your need for the income? And you know, what are your goals in terms of how much risk is appropriate on that equity or other side of the portfolio?
Well, sounds good. And I thank you for the time on the phone.
Jerry, thank you.
Jerry, thank you very much for calling. Let's go to another caller, line two. We have Bonnie in Danville. Good morning. You're on the air on Focus.
Thank you. I have a question on kind of philosophy. I'm close to retirement. I've always had kind of a one-third, two-third division, bonds and stocks. And I know as you approach retirement, a lot of people recommend changing that. My husband is a retired farmer, so we have some farm ground that generates a steady income. And I'm kind of looking at that like a bond as far as asset mix for the two of us together. Am I way off base on that?
You know, I think you could make the argument that having a steady source of income would allow you to take additional risk in your portfolio. The one caution that I might add for you is how stable of an income source are you looking at? For instance, if it was something like a government-guaranteed pension, that might be a very steady source of income, and as long as our government is still liquid, which the state of Illinois right now, one could question. But, you know, something like farm income could fluctuate year to year, whether there be bad crops or changes in commodities, consumer demand, government policy change. So I would be a little bit hesitant in terms of relying on that as a source of income to take on too much additional risk in the portfolio. But certainly any sort of transition in life, I would say, is a good time to review your overall financial plan, as well as more specifically on the investments. That is a good time to make changes to your allocation.
I think Jake's hit the nail on the head. A lot of what you've brought up leads a person to believe that it might be very logical for you to think of the farm income as being more fixed income equivalent. It's nice, and let me make a generalization. I would assume that in central Illinois, it's probably farm ground that's very productive, and it's probably in a corn and bean rotation, and it does not involve livestock. Does that pretty much hit the situation you have?
Yes.
Yeah, then I would say that based on the present structure of agriculture in this country, and I'm talking about a lot of things, whether it's price supports, whether it's federally subsidized crop insurance, all of those types of things that are subject to change. But assuming no great changes to them, you've probably got a closer example with your type of agriculture than any in being closest to a fixed income. You know the old sad joke about livestock, don't you, as a farmer goes? If you win the lotto, you can continue feeding cattle until that money is gone.
Yeah.
So I mean, obviously, there's no pat answer. I think Jake hits a very good point when he says, well, you know, you can think about that. It might be a circumstance that allows you to take more risk in something like an equity component of a portfolio. But again, it's going to be very individualistic answered, and that goes not only to the nature of your agricultural income, but also to the nature of your individual risk preference. So I like to remind people, with human nature being what it is, and most of us being human, it boils down to, do you want to eat well or do you want to sleep well? And that's another way of saying what Jake just said. If you want higher returns, you're going to have to accept higher risk.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, Bonnie, thank you for calling. And I have a question here coming in from email, and person writes, my first great nephew graduated high school this spring. I have seven more great nieces and nephews, one just born last month. I gifted the first great nephew with $1,000. I would like to equally gift the remaining great nephews and nieces, but I don't want to gift them this year, but in the year they graduate high school. I'm able to fund these gifts now. Do I set up a trust, contribute to their already established 529 fund, or what do you suggest? Jake?
Well, for $1,000, the administrative costs of setting up and managing a trust would probably be quite high. So I'm not sure that would be the route that
Are we talking, since there are seven more, maybe $7,000 for all of them?
That's true. But I would say the average trust to be drafted in central Illinois would probably be starting at least several hundred dollars, if not $1,000 or more. And then you've got ongoing administrative costs of making sure that you're keeping in line with all the tax and other regulations revolving around a trust. A 529 is certainly a great option if it's pretty certain that the child is college bound. Another possibility would just be putting the money into something like a CD or another account with a titling of transfer on death or TOD. And the account feature that you would get there is the account would still be in the name of the person who set the account up, but in the event that they passed away before being able to make the gift, the account is similar to a retirement account where you have a beneficiary named and the account would automatically transfer by title from the gifter to the beneficiary named on the account. And you could set that up at pretty much any bank or credit union.
The other suggestion I would have if this person would really think that there's a strong likelihood this money be used for for higher education. Don't overlook something as simple and cheap as double E savings bonds, which also carry the potential, if used for higher education expenses, to have the interest income over time be tax-free if used for educational purposes. So many banks, credit unions, sell double E savings bonds. Basically, you're putting the money into the account now, so to speak, for each one of the great nephews, great nieces, whatever they are. And the longer that money is in there, the greater it will grow to become.
Okay. We are talking about personal finance on Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. There's still time for your personal finance questions for Kevin Wasby and Jake Keebler. Give us a call at 333-9455. You can call us toll-free at 1-800-222-9455. And you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. And, you know, a month ago when you were last on the show, Kevin, we were talking about, among other things, the debate over pension reform in Springfield. And, you know, I was absolutely certain that by now they would have come up with something as far as pension reform. But they haven't. They're still talking about it. They formed a conference committee. They're supposed to report back in 3 weeks. I don't know how this makes anybody agree on anything, but is this something that should affect anybody who's in the state pension systems as far as, you know, thinking what they should be preparing for or what other saving situations they should have on hand?
Well, let me roll back to a month ago, Jim. I think I made mention that I wouldn't be surprised to see this drag on.
So you've been proven right.
No. Unlike your surprise, I guess I'm old enough where I've seen enough crud in the state of Illinois that I don't get surprised often about goings-on between Chicago and Springfield. I'll answer the question this way. Financially, there's nothing going on. There's nothing likely to go on. Nor is there anything I could imagine that might go on that a person can act on right now. If a person affected in terms of being a beneficiary or a future beneficiary of a retirement plan in one of the five state plans, God would hope that you've already done what you should be doing in addition to that future benefit. Bottom line is, again, I'm going to go back to an earlier statement I made today. I don't know the future. What I am not surprised about is the lack of backbone in our legislators to come up with something. So as long as I wake up in the state of Illinois, I guess I'm not going to be surprised with no resolution in that area.
Jake, is this something that clients are asking you about?
It's certainly something that people in this area are very affected by because we have such a high number of people in the SERS and other systems. And I would certainly agree again with Kevin on the fact that we can't see the future. And it's one thing to try to predict the markets, but to try to predict the actions of a politician, I think, is even more difficult. I think I'd also agree that I haven't seen anything that would indicate that there's any action that you could take now to shield yourself from any potential changes. I haven't seen anything that's indicating that there would be a grandfathering of people retired already or anything like that. I think it kind of goes back to not relying on a single source of income in retirement. So for those people who are in a state university or other state retirement plan, to think about ways to supplement that, whether you're eligible for Social Security if you've had enough years where you're not going to be subject to any substantial reductions in Social Security. But even more importantly than that, your own other sources of savings, whether it be tax-deferred retirement accounts like your 403B, Roth IRAs, things like that.
Let's go ahead and take another caller. We are going now to line one to talk to Susan in Champaign. Good morning. You're on the air on Focus.
Yes, well, you just answered part of my question in this last statement, but I did have a question. If you are already retirees from the state university retirement system and there's a possibility of a nursing home for one of us, is there anything special we should be changing and doing as far as our well-rounded savings plan?
So if I understand your question right, you're looking for possibilities of planning for maybe some long-term care needs.
Right, and I'd like to shield us as much as possible, but knowing that we'll have that expense.
Okay. You know, I'm not real familiar in terms of elder law issues get very complex and how Medicaid comes into that issue. But I basically have found that there's three classes of people when it comes to long-term care needs. There's people who have very little in the way of assets, and if they were to need long-term care, they're pretty much going to spend down their assets very quickly and then go on to a state plan like Medicaid. There's then people who have some pretty substantial assets or sources of income set aside such that if they were to need long-term care, even though they may not enjoy paying out thousands of dollars a month, they could afford to do it without substantially affecting their financial situation. And then there's pretty much the rest of us who fall in this middle camp of you've saved and worked hard all of your life, and you've set aside some savings. You've maybe got some sources of income, whether it be pension, Social Security. And in the event that you were to need long-term care, you'll end up either spending a large portion, if not all of your resources. And I think it can be especially challenging for the spouse because what can happen is one of the spouses needs care, draws down a substantial amount of your savings, and then passes away, leaving the second spouse impoverished. So unfortunately, there's not a good solution for everybody. You could certainly take a look at long-term care insurance. There's definitely some pros and cons to it. I think some of the biggest pluses are it is one possible insurance product to kind of pass some of that risk over to an insurance company. But I can tell you it's a fairly newer type of insurance product that's only been around for, you know, 25, 30 years. And because of that, we've seen some pretty substantial rate increases. And it's an expensive product to begin with. I mean, depending on your age, you can be looking at anywhere from $1,000 to several thousand dollars a year per person. So if you're in kind of that middle ground, certainly taking a look at long-term care insurance is an option and weighing that against your own situation in terms of what can you afford. And you can be very flexible with the insurance products that you buy. You know, you don't have to buy a policy that would cover 100% of costs, but maybe you look at buying something that is going to supplement so that you don't completely leave your spouse or children without any resources after that scenario.
Jake, let me also ask, does this, to you, get into an area that might involve a good legal overview, a good part of an estate plan that at least considers these aspects, husband and wife? One of the points you brought up very well was, you know, one person needing care that basically depletes the assets of both. So that's the worst kind of imaginary situation we find ourselves in, which to me kind of brings up the almost crying need. Let's sit down and let's consider that as a possible risk in a good estate plan.
I certainly think that is something to discuss if that's a concern. One of the things that I would find challenging in terms of planning now for a future unknown scenario is that the Medicaid laws are changing, and things that have been put into place in the past to deal with current laws are no longer effective under new rules. For instance, grandfathering rules have changed and gifting rules have changed, and there's even talk of making additional changes that would pretty much eliminate trusts and other things that were set up. So it's a very challenging issue, and you would really need to consult with an attorney who has a lot of experience in that area. And, you know, I'd be looking for an attorney who says that they specialize in elder care issues because it is such a complex field.
Thank you so much.
And thank you very much for calling, Susan. And we are just about out of time here on Focus today. Kevin Waspy and Jake Keebler, thank you for being on the program today. Kevin, a certified financial planner, and Jake Keebler, a financial planner with Bluestem Financial Advisors in Champaign. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Jim.
Thank you, Jim.
Well, welcome any additional thoughts you have about today's program on our website. You can go to it directly at will.illinois.edu/focus. We're likely the first result on your search engine if you type in WILL Focus. Today's show produced by Lindsay Moon. Other members of our Focus team are Pam Dempsey and Kimberly Cronick. Jason Croft is our technical director and handles your calls. Monday on Focus, well, we're looking ahead to the WILL debut of Here and Now. That's a program that's coming to AM 580 middays beginning in July. And we'll hear an encore presentation of my interview with Here and Now's new co-host. He's Jeremy Hobson, who got his start on radio here at WILL. More recently, he was the host of Marketplace Morning Report, heard weekday mornings on WILL. We'll also be talking to our technical director, Jason Croft, who will be putting on a different hat to be the local anchor of Here and Now when that show comes to us in July. All of that on Monday's edition of Focus. Remember, Focus is live each weekday morning at 10 with a replay at 8 p.m. You can hear Focus over the air on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu, where you can also listen to past programs and sign up for our free downloadable podcast at will.illinois.edu/focus. I'm Jim Meadows. This is Focus on WILL.